What's good?
Welcome back to Co-Signed. If you're new here, I'm Mackenzie.
And I'm Sam. We're your hosts of this very real, raw, and hilarious podcast.
You're gonna love it.
So go ahead.
Grab your snacks, your coffee, your wine.
Whatever your vice is.
And let's get into it. Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey. What's happening in your lives, people?
Oh my goodness.
It's Tuesday.
Oh.
Can't say that in any other language, but it's Tuesday. It's a brand new day. You know what that means? It means get your laundry out the dryer, bish. Get those dishes. Do them dishes. We see them piling up.
Mm-hmm. Them dirty ass dishes. Mm-hmm.
Open up your blinds. Make your bed. Let's take today by the balls, baby.
The balls.
Yes. Let's make today great. Let's have a good freaking day. Let's love do it. This. You got this.
You got it.
You got it. Today is our last and final episode of this series.
I'm pretty sad.
I'm kind of sad too. I'm not gonna lie.
It's been pretty fun.
It's been.
I love
it. It's
this
been
shit.
Fun looking up serial killers and talking about horrible crimes.
I was literally just talking about how I regularly fall asleep to like bodies being chopped up on Criminal Minds,
chainsaw sounds.
It's kind of relaxing.
What a great way to fall asleep. And she manages not to dream or have nightmares. Like,
right.
Wait.
I do have some messed up dreams.
But it is our final episode of this series. It's been so much fun doing it. We're probably going to do another one in the future.
And honestly, like we said last week, we were going to get some good ones that really mess you guys up. And we did just that.
Both of them are.
We do not know each other's case yet.
No, that we kept it exciting.
So
we didn't want to know about it until the other person read it.
We've both never heard of each other, so
we're
this
not
is gonna be fun. This is gonna be an authentic reaction.
Yes. So we're gonna switch things up a little bit. We're not gonna do any Netflix suggestions, but I am gonna read two interesting facts, and then we're gonna get into it. Okay. So interesting fact number one. A serial killer, I guess we should have started on episode one of this series, but the definition of a serial killer is typically a person who murders three or more people, usually in service of abnormal psychological gratification, with the murders taking place over more than a month and including a significant period of time between them. While most authorities set a threshold of three murders, others extend it to four or lessen it to two. If you watch Criminal Minds or any other crime show, you probably know that psychological gratification is the usual motive for serial killing, and most serial killings involve sexual contact with the victim. But the FBI states that the motives of serial killers can include anger, thrill-seeking, financial gain, and attention-seeking. The murders may be attempted or completed in a similar fashion. And the victims may have something in common, for example, demographic profile, appearance, gender, or race. If you watch Criminal Minds, we know that well.
Right.
And it's called a profile. Now, interesting fact number two. Female serial killers are rare compared to males, as we all know. Sources suggest that female serial killers represent less than one in every six known serial murderers in the United States between 1800 and 2004.
See, y'all think women span. Are crazy.
Mm-hmm. 64 females from a total of 416 known offenders, around 15% of U.S. serial killers have been women, with a collective number of victims between 427 and 612. But that is, again, between 1800 and 2004.
Right.
There's your interesting facts.
Woo!
Wee! Wee! All right, before Sam jumps into her story, I'm going to read a trigger warning, and this serves for both of ours because they're both fall under this category. But before we jump into the story, these stories are pretty intense, pretty brutal, and involve just about everything. A lot of the times we just want to tell the story and skip over certain details, but with both of these cases, it's hard to do that. So it's definitely for mature audiences. It contains extremely detailed and graphic descriptions of crime scenes and adult dialogue and so on and so forth. So listener discretion is heavily advised.
AKA this shit
f***ed up. What she said.
Okay, so I did someone I had never heard of. One of the most disturbing things I've ever read in my life. So
I'm ready.
His name,
I think,
is Yakeem Kroll. Okay. So Yakeem Kroll was born in 1933 during the beginning of the Nazi Party's rise in Germany. The youngest of 8 children, he was considered weak and was constantly degraded by his family.
Hmm.
He was a frequent bedwetter as a child, which caused him a lot of humiliation. He's also said to have sexually abused animals.
Oh my gosh.
Both bedwetting and animal cruelty are components of the triad, a set of childhood behaviors that can point to violent tendencies later in life. Like many other families in Germany, during World War II, his family suffered from extreme poverty and hunger. His father, a soldier in the German army, was taken as a POW, which is prisoner of war, by the Russian army and is believed to have died during the war, leaving him and his 7 siblings alone with their mother. Yakeem quit school in 1948 after having to repeat several grades more than once. At 15 years old, with a 4th grade education, his struggles in school were compounded by the disruptions of World War II. Later in life, testing revealed that he had an IQ of 78, and some reports claim Kroll didn't even know how to read.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Just prepare yourself for what's to come.
Okay.
After leaving school, Kroll started working as a farmhand and soon developed his appetite for murder. While working as a farmhand, he said that helping kill farm animals inspired his fantasies. When he saw a pig being slaughtered, the incident, and I quote, he said, awakened his sex drive. As a young man, he did attempt to have a romantic relationship with one unknown woman. He said that he felt awkward and inadequate with women sexually and described his only sexual encounter with women as a failure. I don't know what that means, but I'm assuming it did not go well.
Right. One can only assume.
Kroll then decided to have sexual encounters with, quote, someone who could not complain about his performance.
Oh, gosh. I don't like where this is going.
In 1955, as his obsession with death grew, his mother also died. The Kroll siblings all went their separate ways and they all lost touch. Later that year, Yakeem murdered his first victim. On February 8th, 1955, he traveled to the village of Wellstead. There he captured and murdered 19-year-old Irmgard Strahl. He strangled her to death, then raped her, and slashed open her abdomen. So he raped her after she was dead.
So he defiled her.
Yes. Along with raping victims after their death, he also reportedly masturbated over their bodies.
I'm sorry, your face. Oh my God.
Finally, when he got home from a kill, he would pleasure himself again with a rubber sex doll, often while choking a small child's doll.
Okay.
Kroll would later claim that after his first killing, his murder subsided until 4 years later. However, authorities believe that he was responsible for several more murders between 1955 and 1959, which is when he said he started killing again. His next known murder took place on June 16, 1959, when 24-year-old Clara Tesmer was killed in Rhine. Clara's murder was identical to the first victim, only this time he began to engage in what became his trademark, cannibalism. He removed pieces of Clara's flesh from her butt and thighs, wrapped them up, and took them home to cook for dinner.
As you do.
Yeah. You know. A local man in Rhine named Henrik Ott was arrested for Clara's murder and hanged himself while awaiting trial. Meanwhile, Yakeem was free. So
they got the wrong person.
Yeah. Those who have studied Yakeem Kroll's psychology know that his self-awareness and methodical ways of selecting victims point to Kroll having a higher IQ than his reported score of 78. Like other serial killers, he traveled to different towns to look for his victims. He mainly murdered women and girls, but he didn't stick to one age group or type like killers often do.
Right.
He even murdered one man, Herman Schmitz, in 1965. That night, Kroll had seen Schmitz and his fiance in a secluded area having sex in the front seat of a car, and he got an idea. He lured Schmitz out of the car by waving his arms as if he needed help. Then he stabbed him repeatedly, planning to kill and rape the fiance next. Instead, she leaped into the driver's seat of the car and drove directly at him. He dodged the vehicle and ran away, so she got away. Although she got a good look at him, her account of the nondescript killer didn't turn up any leads. Kroll remained free to carry out even more crimes. Further confusing police, Kroll did not always strip victims of flesh to engage in cannibalism, making each murder different. He preferred to take these cuts only from the victims that he viewed as particularly young and tender.
Hmm.
Delicious.
Love those adjectives.
Plus, other killers operating in West Germany had the police distracted at the time. In the years before Joachim began killing, Werner Boost had been murdering couples in the area starting in the early 1950s. Boost and several other suspected killers are believed to have thrown police off of Kroll's track. Even worse, while Kroll was actively killing, five other men, along with Henrik Ott, were arrested and charged for his murders. Like Ott, one of these men also committed suicide while awaiting trial. Another disturbing element of Kroll's murders was the motivation behind the cannibalism. Many cannibalistic serial killers, such as Albert Fish, are sexually motivated to consume their victim's flesh or see it as a trophy. Kroll had a more practical view of the act. He later said he only took the pieces of flesh from his victims because meat was expensive. Joachim Kroll's cannibalistic crime spree came to an end on July 3rd, 1976. And I'm sorry for what you are about to hear. That day, Kroll kidnapped 4-year-old Marion Kettner from a park. A little later, a neighbor asked Kroll if he knew what was blocking the pipes in the building's shared lavatory. When he replied, guts, the neighbor chuckled. Then he looked in the toilet and saw tiny human organs and immediately contacted the police. Once inside Kroll's apartment, police found Marion's dismembered body. Parts of the body were in the refrigerator. A hand was cooking on the stove, and the organs clogged the plumbing. Police removed the shared toilet and found the boy's liver, lungs, kidneys, and heart. Kroll was immediately arrested, admitted to murdering the boy, and gave police details of 13 other murders, including the killings of Irmgard and Clara. He also confessed to the cannibalism. While in prison, he eagerly cooperated with police, convinced he would be giving an operation that would cure his homicidal urges and then he would be released. So delusional. After several years in incarceration, he was charged with 8 murders and 1 attempted murder in a trial that went on for 151 days. Can you imagine being on that jury?
Literally half of the year.
Can you imagine? In the end, instead of receiving the cure he wanted, he was sentenced to life in prison in April of 1982. He died in prison in 1991 of a heart attack at 58 years old.
The year I was born, yay.
I knew you were going to say that.
This all happened in Germany?
Yes.
So here's what I want to know. This is one of the questions that came to mind as you were telling. What do you mean the police were tied up with other people? There's someone literally, y'all not have enough police to go around? What do you, you're all just following each other to, like, someone is literally eating people and you're tied up. I'm sorry.
It's the,
what?
It's the, he would, they said the females, he would always have sex with their dead body, which is creepy in itself.
It starts with a
necrophiliac.
Yeah, I was going to say necrophiliac.
Like Ted Bundy.
Yeah. I think this man has, Joachim or whatever his name is, has Ted, old Teddy boy beat.
Yes. Yeah, the 4-year-old's the most disturbing part, I think.
And how do you feel being the neighbor just going, no, really, like, what's blocking the pies?
Right.
No, like, guts.
Yeah.
Like, I'm telling you the truth.
And out of all the things, why is he cooking a hand?
Oh, my God, that poor little boy.
Yeah.
And you can only imagine what he did to him.
Yeah.
Before.
Because he said he would torture them.
If you've been doing females this entire time... And the only reason you killed that one man is just to get to his wife or girlfriend, whoever. Why are you just not randomly picking a little boy?
Right. Yeah. Very weird.
It's very strong. Oh,
and
gosh.
If you look up his picture, he's a creepy looking dude.
Here's what I have. The last thing I want to say before I tell mine. I don't ever want anyone of the male species to ever come at me about, oh, why are females so scared of us? Y'all don't have anything to be scared of. It's not all men. You know what? You're right. It's not all men, but it's enough of you.
Yeah.
You don't walk around in fear that you're going to get, you know, skinned alive and worn as a face mask. Do you?
Right.
You really don't. Like, men don't have to, you know, be scared to walk to their car at night or hold their keys in a certain way. Or, you know, look over your shoulder. Or like us, mm-hmm. downtown that night. Oh, creepy old minivan just pulls up in front of you and stops and tries to wave you over. I don't see any of you old Chads and Brads getting waved over to a minivan.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear that.
We just linked arms and kept it moving. Yeah, and then that guy was like, oh, I'm not trying to scare you. Okay, well, you failed.
Okay, well, that scares me. That statement scares me. Bye-bye.
Right.
Whoever you are. I can't see you, but I don't want to look. Weird. But that's a good one. That was a good one.
He's a creepy dude. Mm.
So today, we're going to talk about Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. Or it's a weird last name, but it's Paul and Carla, okay? Carla was a 17-year-old high school student. She had a part-time job working at a local pet shop when she first met Paul. Paul was 23 and attending the University of Toronto, studying to become an accountant. Now, it was said that he was doing pretty well in school and on his way to graduate. In October of 1987, Carla was at a pet convention in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. She's working this convention, and as the night ended, her and her coworker went down to the hotel restaurant to grab some food. That's when Paul walks into the restaurant. Carla and Paul made eye contact almost immediately, her friend said, and when he walked in, there was an instant connection. Paul was over 6 foot tall, was said to be very good looking, super charming, and he actually approached Carla and the two started, you know, just chatting it up. They just clicked instantly, and her coworker that was with Carla was very much like, okay, well, I'm gonna get out of here. You two just like do what it do. So she takes off. Paul and Carla end up sitting at that restaurant for hours talking about anything and everything. And when the restaurant closed, they headed up to Carla's hotel room, where they engaged in sexual activities. And before you're like, oh my God, Mackenzie, she's 17. The age of consent in Canada, from my understanding, is 16. So it's legal. There's very much an age difference. She's 17, he's 23. It's nothing we probably haven't seen before.
Right.
So Carla's believing that Paul is like the man of her dreams, right? And the two made a very good-looking couple. They were both blonde, tan skin, you know, Ken and Barbie, if you will. Paul also told many of his friends that it was a match made in heaven and that he had found his soulmate. And they both said that they would do anything for the other person.
Mm. As one does.
Mm. Anything. That's where it gets tricky.
Uh-huh.
Now, Carla was born to Dorothy and Carl Homolka in Ontario in 1970. She was the oldest of three girls. She was very pretty, very popular growing up, and she lived in St. Catharines, which is a province of Ontario, Canada. It was said that when she was in school, she had many boyfriends, had many boys interested in her also, but once she met Paul, it was a wrap. That's all she could talk about to her friends is Paul, Paul, Paul. He was older. He was in college. She apparently bragged about this and about him all the time. And then her friends thought he was so cool. Paul was born in August of 1964 in Ontario to Kenneth and Marilyn Bernardo. The Bernardos were, quote, financially well off, stable middle class family. Paul was the youngest of three children. And it was said that he was a pretty sweet kid, charming smile, but he did have a difficult upbringing. His mother would verbally abuse him and his siblings, and when he was 16, he actually found out that the man that he thought was his dad was not actually his biological father.
Damn.
This obviously upset him, and it broke all trust with his parents. Now, I read different things on how he actually found out. Some say he actually found some paperwork or found evidence and, like, asked his mom about it. And other claims say that his mom, in the middle of verbally abusing him and his siblings, like, blurted it out. Either way, it affected him because this was around the age where he would start watching his female neighbors through their windows as they undressed, aka a peeping Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And these women did not know that he was doing this.
Oh.
As he got older, peeping through windows just didn't cut it for him anymore. And he said his fantasies started to become darker and darker and darker. He said he would dream about taking advantage and control over women, but at this specific age, he wasn't acting on it just yet. But the thoughts were definitely there and starting to happen, which, you know, yay. Mm. In September 1983, that's when Paul started studying at the University of Toronto. And anyone who knew him really liked him and said that he had so much charm and could really make friends with anyone. Overall, people wanted to be around him, and he was seen as the life of the party. Like, if Paul was there, it was going to be a good time. And I read that he did have a few girlfriends in college, but things, you know, would start off really well. But as time went on, the relationship or the sexual aspects of the relationship would turn violent, abusive, and controlling. And at that point, that's when the girls would break things off with him.
Yeah.
So he didn't really have too many that lasted. Now, in the spring of 1988, a sexual predator was roaming the streets of Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. By May, 7 different women had gone to the local police sharing reports about their attacks. These attacks all included beatings, intense verbal abuse, and dire threats to discourage the victims from going to the police, which led authorities to conclude that they had all been by the same man. The police got on TV warning women not to be outside at night alone, don't stay out super late unless you were with a group of people, because whoever this attacker was, they would grab women when they would leave the bus stop at night or when they would run through the parks at night. Some attacks actually did happen when they were running through the park. The attacker would grab them from behind, take them behind some bushes or to a secluded area, and that's where they would be assaulted. And by assault, he was raping these women. The Scarborough predator would force his victims to perform oral sex, sodomy, or to have sex with him, and would most of the time be beaten afterwards. It was pretty intense and pretty scary. Like I said, there were 7 women at this point coming to the police about these attacks. The first few were just about, you know, a man groping them or rubbing up against them or whatever. But as the number of women started growing, the reports of the attacks were getting more intense. The media actually is the one who named the predator the Scarborough Rapist. Naturally, everyone's on edge, high alert, uneasy. The police had statements from all victims, some eyewitnesses, but couldn't seem to get an accurate or a repetitive description because the women were obviously attacked from behind.
Yeah.
They couldn't get a clear picture. All they could tell was that it was a man, definitely a man. He was young and he had light colored hair. That's all they could tell.
So everybody.
Yeah. As time went on, police were able to collect about 100 different DNA samples from potential leads, but had no matches. That's when the Toronto police called in an FBI profiler to create a profile of who this guy was. This specific FBI agent analyzed all police reports and all the information they had and was able to connect 4 more attacks to this person, which brought the total number of victims to 11 at this time. This FBI agent also determined that these attacks were anger-based and sadistic in nature, which is a very rare combination. But whoever this person was extremely dangerous. They also felt that he was a high-functioning, intelligent, psychopathic, sexually sadistic offender. And they lived in the area, probably in a family home. This person was more than likely in their 20s and probably had a violent or toxic relationship with women in their family or women that they've known. Again, Paul and Carla met in 1987. And by this time that they had met, there had already been 3 reports made on the Scarborough rapist. Of course, Carla never suspected Paul could be linked to these crimes because their relationship was so picture perfect. He always showed up with flowers, he would give her gifts any chance he could, and he treated her really well and would constantly tell her how he wanted to spend his life with her. Their relationship did move pretty quickly, but I guess that's what happens when you're infatuated, right? But back to 1988.
That is what happened.
Yeah. So, they had been dating for over 18 months at this point in 1988, and Paul literally drove over 80 miles to visit Carla in St. Catharines a few times a week. So, that's a lot of driving back and forth. But Carla's family loved Paul. In love with him. They thought he was the greatest catch. He was well educated. His life was on the right track. So they didn't mind the age difference between the two. Like, they thought he was just chef's kiss. A lot of times we have this image, and we actually just talked about this. We have this image of people that, you know, these people that look like monsters, and they're these horrible beings and creatures. Like, ew. But a lot of the time these people look very normal.
Yeah.
And even attractive mm-hmm. to a lot of people. And
that's why women trust them.
Right. And they're like I just said, normal looking. And I just want to throw that out there because clearly nobody saw this coming. Mm-hmm. So in the spring of 1989, Carla graduated from high school and was trying to figure out what she's doing with her life. And remember I told you that Carla used to brag to her friends about Paul. That was great, blah, 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 blah. Well, it went from her telling her friends how great he was to her telling them how verbally abusive he's becoming towards her.
Mm. Can only hide it for so long.
Mm-hmm. It always seemed that after an argument, Carla would forgive Paul and he'd apologize for his wrongdoings and maybe give her a gift or two to show that he was sorry and they would just move on from it. But things were definitely changing between the two.
Toxic as fuck.
Mm-hmm. In December of 1989, Paul and Carla went on a romantic getaway to Niagara Falls. He proposed to her here, and she said yes. They came home and told their families, and everyone was thrilled. They ended up setting a wedding date for spring of 1991. In May of 1990, police released a sketch of who they thought this Scarborough rapist looked like to the public, which was on the front pages of, like, all the newspapers, like, everywhere it could be, flyers. The description that came with the sketch read, quote, white male, 18 to 23 years old, 5'10 to 6 foot, medium muscular build, clean shaven, tanned complexion, light colored eyes, possibly blue, with blonde hair parted on the left side. A very descriptive, detailed account. Paul's friends are seeing this sketch everywhere, and basically, like, they start talking to each other, like, have you seen this? Like, this is Paul. Like, this looks like Paul. Like, what do we do? One of Paul's best friends at the time actually contacts the Toronto police station and says that the drawing looks like his friend, Paul Bernardo, which the police obviously make a note of. And by November of 1990, several other people had contacted them saying the sketch looked like Paul. By this time, police are like, okay, let's check this dude out. So they actually find Paul, they bring him in for questioning and ask him if they can collect a DNA sample from him. He complied. The DNA was sent to be tested, but of course at this time, this is 1990, they had hundreds of samples, like I told you. They're just waiting to be tested.
Yeah.
So Paul's goes into the rest of them and just essentially sits on a shelf or in a cabinet, wherever. And it's just waiting around. A very unfortunate move. After Paul was questioned, I'm not sure if he got, like, freaked out or he just didn't care, but he actually ends up moving from Scarborough to St. Catharines to live with Carla and her family. Paul and Carla thought it would be best to move into her parents' house to save money, you know, all that jazz. And coincidentally enough, once Paul moved out of Scarborough, the crimes and or attacks stopped happening there and seemed to pick up in St. Catharines. Funny how that happens.
It's not obvious.
Mm-hmm. Again, the family did not think that Paul could be responsible in any way. They absolutely adored him, especially Carla's 15-year-old sister, Tammy. She just absolutely adored him, thought he was the brother that, she's never had. Unfortunately, Paul was developing very dark urges toward Tammy.
I kind of saw this coming.
It was said that he would watch her undress from time to time when she was unaware, you know, as creepers do. Paul gave into his urges, and he actually told Carla that he wanted something that Carla could not give him, a virgin or virginity. He made Carla feel very bad because she's clearly not a virgin. They've been together for a while. But the closest thing that he said to Carla was Tammy. That he wanted Tammy's virginity.
Disgusting.
He's pressuring Carla to let him have her sister, and Carla is actually starting to give in because she did not want him to leave her. Okay, I'm going to remind you the details that are coming next may be triggering for some, so again, listener discretion is advised. Wanting to please Paul, Carla comes up with a plan that they're going to drug Tammy so Paul can have sex with her. And what's so disturbing is that this was Carla's Christmas present to Paul. Mm-hmm. So December 23rd, 1990, the whole family is going to bed, but Carla and Paul ask Tammy to stay up with them. Carla was making alcoholic drinks for the three of them, and she crushed up pills, put them in Tammy's drink. At this time, Carla was working at a vet clinic, like I told you, which she stole animal tranquilizers, which is what she put in her sister's drink. In Carla's mind, she thought that this would be the best solution so that she could use these on her sister. She would just be asleep while Paul took advantage of her. And Carla also soaked a rag in halothane, which is a general anesthetic, and she held it over her sister's face while Paul raped her. They also recorded the entire thing on a video camera. Now, when Paul was done, he told Carla it was her turn, which she did, and they also recorded that on tape. Soon after all of this, Tammy began vomiting and choking. Paul and Carla start freaking out. They hide the camera, put Tammy's clothes back on her, and call the ambulance. When the paramedics arrive, Paul and Carla tell them that they tried to revive her after she passed out from drinking, but they couldn't. Tammy ended up being taken to the hospital, where she was later pronounced dead.
Oh my God.
One of the doctors that examined Tammy noticed a burn around her mouth. This was obviously from when Carla was holding the
chemicals,
the rag on her mouth. But Carla and Paul said it was from rug burn, from them trying to pull her off the bed to the floor. And apparently this pitiful answer was enough for the examiner to conclude Tammy's death from natural causes. At 15, just natural causes. Carla's parents were completely devastated, but actually believed that Tammy's death was just a tragic accident. She was a teenager, and teenagers sometimes experiment with drugs and alcohol, and they believe this is what happened to Tammy, and she just took it too far.
Wow, that poor girl.
So, a month goes by.
This was on Christmas?
Mm-hmm, 2 days before Christmas.
Wow.
So, a month goes by. Carla and Paul have saved enough money to get their own place. It was a two-story home right outside of St. Catharines in Ontario. When the two moved in to their own place, it was said that's when Paul's abuse, it really went up a notch. He would jokingly tell Carla that he was a Scarborough rapist and went from being just verbally abusive to now being physically abusive as well. When Carla would threaten to leave him, he would tell her that he was going to go to the police and tell them all about her involvement with Tammy's death and that he had it on videotape to prove it. So he was blackmailing her.
Oh my God.
So if he was going down with, then she was going down with him. June 15th, 1991, 2 weeks before their wedding, Paul came home with a surprise for Carla. Now, you would think it was some flowers or jewelry, something like that. No, he came home with a 14-year-old girl named Leslie Mahaffey. Paul said Leslie was in her backyard. He pulled up, offered her a cigarette. When she approached the car and got in, that's when he kidnapped her. Carla and Paul ended up holding her captive, assaulting her repeatedly, all while filming it, just like they did Tammy. After holding her captive for a little over 24 hours, they ended up strangling her, dismembering her body. They took parts of her body, mixed them up into multiple concrete blocks, and dumped them into Lake Gibson. On July 29, 1991, Carla and Paul got married with over 100 friends and family around them to celebrate their special day. But on that very same day, a fisherman came across some of those body parts they threw in the lake, and it was all over the news. The community was absolutely horrified. Over the next year, police looked into clues and leads as to who Leslie's killer actually could be. And that's when they brought in that same FBI profiler from the Scarborough rapist. At the time, the profiler said that he had no reason to connect the two cases together.
Right, so that's way different.
So there was no connection being made between the two at the time. And they had no leads either. As time went on, Paul and Carla's life continued as a newly married couple, but of course, Paul was getting pretty cocky because he's getting away with these things. Yeah. But he's just wanting more. He's wanting more. He's feeling like he can get away with it because, you know, he is. So, Paul asked Carla to get in touch with some of Tammy's best friends, her sister's best friends, because he wants to invite them over to their house and essentially do the same thing they did to Tammy, to her best friends. Over the next year, Carla was able to get several young girls to come to their house where they would drug them and assault them. But these victims survived the attacks. They woke up the next day having absolutely no memory or recollection from what happened. The majority of these attacks were caught on videotape and kept in Paul's growing collection, if you will. April 16th, 1992, Paul and Carla went on a little drive with the intention to find a girl and bring her home. On this drive, they spotted 15-year-old Kristen French. She was walking home from school. They drove past her, pulled into a church parking lot, and waited for her to walk by. Carla was in the passenger seat, and she called out to Kristen, asking her for directions. And when Kristen walked up to the car to help, that's when they shoved her into the car and took her back to their house. And it wasn't long before Kristen was reported missing, and witnesses came forward saying that they had seen Kristen in the church parking lot talking to a car with two people inside. They also saw them drive away in a beige Camaro.
Oh, shit.
Now, they had the description of the car. Police started searching all over for every single beige Camaro. Tons of billboards were put up with the car's description saying, "Have you seen this car?" But what they didn't know was that the eyewitnesses' accounts were actually incorrect. It was not a beige Camaro. Paul and Carla actually drove a gold Nissan. Now, looking for at pictures of the car, I did see, you can tell where the confusion would have been, but it wasted a lot of time.
Yeah.
The media were actually the ones who started linking the disappearance of Kristen to the murder of Leslie. The police hadn't even, like, thought about connecting the two, but the media was the ones like, no, these two were, they're about the same person. FBI profiler still was like, no, there's no connection. The profile he gave of these two cases were, tell me if this sounds familiar, white male, late 20s. Probably has had a history of violent sexual crimes, domestic violence, and someone who was more than likely violent in their personal relationships. And it's where you kind of ask yourself, how are you not making the connection, you know?
Yeah.
Paul and Carla kept Kristen captive for several days where they videotaped their assaults on her. And when Paul was satisfied, that's when they strangled and killed her. April 30th, 1992, her body was found more than 30 miles away, and it was left in a ditch at a local cemetery. So let's fast forward to January of 1993. Paul ends up beating Carla so bad that she went to the ER to receive treatment. He attacked her with a torch, giving her two really bad black eyes, a broken rib, and severe bruising. After 2 years of marriage, it was at this point that Carla said, you know what, I'm leaving him. I'm leaving Paul. Around the same time, Paul's DNA was finally being tested against the Scarborough rapist. Mm-hmm. Finally.
Like 2 years later. Shit.
Yeah, it's been a while. So his DNA was positively matched as the man responsible for these attacks, and police are finally connecting the two towns together, Scarborough and St. Catharines. Before going straight to Paul, police actually reached out to Carla and wanted, essentially, to create a wedge between the two. They felt that they could get more out of her than Paul. Carla actually thought that she was being called in to be questioned about the domestic assault, but after the interview with police, she went back to her family, where she broke down and confessed everything to them, including about her sister. She was afraid that the police already knew everything that she was involved with, or at least close to figuring it out, so she wanted to tell her parents before, you know, shit hit the fan. So her parents actually suggested that she hires a lawyer, which she did, and she tells her lawyer that Paul was the Scarborough rapist and also admitted to being involved with two local murders and the death of her own sister. She ended up agreeing to testifying in court against Paul in exchange for a reduced sentence for herself. Police agreed to the terms, so Carla sits down and gives them a full-blown confession. There are a lot of debates surrounding this story, and one of them being Carla's actual involvement. So she told police that she was a victim in all of this, too. Like, she was a victim of his. That Paul forced her to do these things. I watched a few clips of her being questioned, and I think she's a lot smarter than what she was like letting on to be.
Sure.
Because even down to like what she's wearing, it's very much like innocent schoolgirl when she's being questioned by the police, which is fine, but that's not how she normally dressed in any other picture you see.
Yeah.
And when she would answer like questions, she would answer very innocent, like, then he like chopped her up and I was like I was just so scared. Like, that's how she was talking. Mm-hmm. A high-pitched little girl voice. And she talked like that the whole time. After Paul gets arrested, I kind of jumped there, but after Paul gets arrested, they ask Carla to go with them to the couple's home and show them and describe in detail where everything would take place. I need you to tell me what happened with this girl, what happened with this girl, like, tell me everything. When and how and what you did. For example, she walks in them into the bathroom and she's like, and this is where we put her in the tub and we bathed her and then dismembered her. And then she literally would turn around to the bathroom sink and goes, can I ask you guys something? Like, where did all my perfumes go? Like, I had a bunch of perfume samples here, like, and they just took everything. Like, am I going to get those back? Like, you're literally recounting a murder and your mind is on perfume.
Yeah.
Very, very bizarre. She also doesn't really show a lot of emotion when she's doing, like, walking them through here, because this is all on tape.
Yeah.
But the moment that she talks about how one of the victims came over and Paul actually takes out their really expensive champagne flutes, you can just see, like, she gets emotional over these champagne flutes as she's telling the police, like, you know, how he decided he wanted to drug the girls with these champagne flutes. She's like, those glasses were from France and they were very expensive and, you know, we never use them except for a special occasion. I was just so mad that he would use them.
My God. Priorities.
Right. That's literally what I said to a girl. Hashtag priorities. Like, she's physically getting worked up about glassware, but not about dismembering a body.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This just keeps happening after they're walking through, like, the house, room after room. And she's asking about, like, furniture and about books and if she's going to get things back and if she can keep certain things. Like, my mind when I'm seeing it, I'm like, do you not understand, like, what's happening right now?
Right.
And I feel like, is she being calculated? Like, is she, like, trying to set up, like, the innocent, like, or, like, insane card?
Mm-hmm.
But Carla keeps telling police that Paul forced her to participate in every attack against her will. And she also tells police that there are videotapes hidden somewhere in the house.
Oh, my God.
And have literally just about everything on them. But she doesn't know where they're hidden. They're just in the house. Paul hid them. On February 17th, 1993, Paul Bernardo was arrested. They began searching the home to find these tapes. That was going to be like their smoking gun. They didn't really honestly have anything else except Carla's confession and these so-called tapes. They ended up spending 71 days searching the home and did not find these tapes. They arranged their plea agreement with Carla because they didn't find the tapes and they had no other direct evidence that actually linked him to the crimes or the murders, and all they basically had was Carla's testimony. So this deal actually was kept secret from the public, which ended up causing like a whole ordeal once it became known. But in June 28th, 1993, Carla appeared in court for her involvement for the crimes. The court put a publication ban on her trial, which is very odd for courts to do at the time. And this caused like a huge upset with like media and the public because their right to know was being denied. And this was like a big case, like people wanted to know. Also forgot to mention that it was actually the United States that dubbed them like the Ken and Barbie killers. It wasn't Canada, so you know, you have America glorifying and glamorizing murder, but they said they're so attractive, they're like Ken and Barbie, how could they ever be killers?
Wow.
So Carla was convicted on manslaughter charges.
What?
And received a 12-year sentence, causing, I mean, as you can imagine, a huge uproar. But the plea deal was said to be kept a secret in order to ensure that Paul had a, quote, fair trial. Carla was sent to prison, and in August of 1993, she filed for divorce from Paul. May 18th, 1995, 2 years later, Paul's trial began. He, of course, pleaded not guilty on all 9 charges in connection to the deaths of Leslie and Kristen. The prosecution presented new evidence during the trial that was unknown at the time. It was the tapes. They ended up finding them.
Oh, shit.
This was the first time that they had direct evidence against Paul and Carla. And up until now, all they had was Carla's word to go on.
So she kind of got lucky because Double Jeopardy can't.
The tapes obviously revealed a completely different version of events that Carla told and described. And they felt like Carla deliberately misled them.
Well, no shit.
The tapes clearly show Carla willfully participating, and had the tapes surfaced sooner, they most definitely would have rejected her plea deal. Now, if I was Paul's attorney, I'd be like, shit, the tapes. You know, they got the tapes. But no. They said, sure, he's on the tapes, but you never see him murdering anyone on the tapes. Paul says it wasn't him who actually murdered the victims, that it was Carla. June 19th, 1995, Carla testifies against Paul in his trial, where she stated that she's sticking to her victim story, I'm a victim in all this, that he was the mastermind behind it all, not her. And when Carla was asked about the tapes and herself on them, she said she suffered from, quote, battered spouse syndrome.
Oh my God.
Many feel or believe that her reason was completely BS because the tapes show her as more of an accomplice than a victim or being forced. The judge allowed the jurors to watch all of the tapes, but only allowed the ones inside the courtroom to listen and not view them because he didn't want the families to have to relive or live through more grief by viewing what their loved ones had to endure.
Can you imagine having to watch that?
Yeah. Now, Paul's trial lasted for months, and at the end of it in September 1995, the jury deliberated for 5 hours and found 31-year-old Paul Bernardo guilty of all 9 charges against him, including the 2 murders. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole for at least 25 years. While in prison, Paul confesses to 14 more sexual assaults of women. Most were in 1986, a year before police actually caught on to the Scarborough rapist, and this was a year before him and Carla met. The judge designated him as a dangerous offender, making it unlikely that he will ever be released on parole. In 2006, now we're jumping, 2006, Bernardo gave a prison interview suggesting that he had reformed and would make a good parole candidate. He became eligible to petition a jury to be allowed to apply for early parole in 2008 under the Faint Hope Clause. Since he committed multiple murders before 1997, he applied, but they didn't give it to him. Now, in 2015, Bernardo became eligible and applied for day parole in Toronto. According to the victim's lawyers, it is unlikely that Paul will ever be released from prison because of the dangerous offender status. He scored a 35 out of 40 on the psychopathy checklist, a psychological assessment tool used to assess the presence of psychopathy in individuals. This score is literally classified as clinical psychopathy, 35 out of 40. In October of 2018, Paul had been set to go to trial for possession of a shank while incarcerated. He had a 5-centimeter long screw attached to a pin. However, the prosecution dropped these charges due to their determination that there was no reasonable probability of conviction. Paul became eligible for parole in February 2018, but in October of 2018, he was denied day and full parole by the Parole Board of Canada.
Thank God.
Now, I do want to put a little side note in here that the Criminal Minds episode called Mr. and Mrs. Anderson contains a serial killer couple loosely based on Paul and Carla, and the Bernardo case was mentioned actually by the BAU team when they delivered the profile to local police. Another great debate in this case is whether or not Carla got off too easily. Many believe that she was just as sick, if not more sick, than Paul, and whatever was on those tapes showed a much darker side of Carla than anyone had ever seen. Now, I didn't look them up. I don't want to see them.
Yeah,
I didn't care to. But from what I just saw, like, with police interviews and, like, jurors, she seemed, like, almost thrilled to be doing these things.
I believe it. I mean, you don't help someone if you're not.
Right. Her plea deal has become known as one of the worst in Canadian history. July 4th, 2005, 35-year-old Carla was released from prison, having served her measly little 12-year sentence. She couldn't go back to St. Catharines. She wasn't welcome there at all. So she moved to Montreal, where she started a new life. Carla said that she's had nightmares almost every night about all the girls and has felt great remorse about what she's done. She also went to court to try and change her name, but was denied the right because she's technically a public figure. Now, I did read that they have, like, actual pictures of Paul and Carla in what is called the Museum of Death, and it's in Los Angeles. And the pictures are of them, like Carla, like, holding, like, up a head. And she's, like, smiling. Yeah, it's gross. So, that is the...
disturbing.
Very brutal, disturbing, traumatizing, vomit-worthy case of Paul and Carla. The Ken and Barbie killers of Canada.
Two very disgusting cases.
Ba-da-ba-ba.
Why do I always start with a McDonald's theme
song?
I don't even eat McDonald's.
Yeah, because it's sick.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Love it.
All right. We hope, we really hope you guys have enjoyed the series.
I know.
This episode of Carissa.
Yeah.
You know, we hope that you don't have to keep your nightlight on or...
I hope you do.
Deadbolt your door. I mean, you might still
look
want to do that.
Look out for
Yakim. Safety. Jotram. Look out for Yakim. What is it?
Yakim.
Yakim, Paul, and Carla.
Well, Carla's out there.
Carla's
somewhere.
Out.
So be... Watch out.
Watch out for Carla. So.
Maybe I don't want to visit Canada.
Right. At least not Montreal. Apparently that's where she's at. But we appreciate you guys listening to the series, keeping up with it. It was really fun. We'll probably do it again.
Yeah, definitely.
And don't forget to follow our Instagram.
Woo.
Co.signpodcast.
We say it every week.
Every week. We are actually, and we say this
every week.
We're actually getting down to the wire to where we're going to be doing our very first giveaway.
Yes.
So if you were here last week, you know that we are going to start giving you a secret word.
Yes, we have decided.
We have. Drum roll. What's our secret word?
It's going to be Starbucks.
Starbucks, 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 Starbucks. Yes, it's basic, but you know, it has to, it's pertaining to what you may or may not be winning. So, follow along, follow our Instagram where you will know exactly when and how to enter. And you want to know the secret word because if we message you and say, hey, oh my God, you win, and you don't know the word, well, you don't win anymore.
Right.
We're going to win. Yeah, nah. So you have to know the secret word, guys. And it's not always going to be in the outro. So you make sure you listen the whole way through.
Yeah.
Going to be placing it.
Can't win if you don't listen.
Oh.
Don't say it.
I like that. All right, guys. Every single week, we will be back next Tuesday.
Every single Tuesday.
All right, guys. We've had so much fun. Thank you for spending your Tuesday or part of your Tuesday with us. We'll see you next week.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye.
Oh, my God.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.